And then they had one particular meeting right before I resigned when I said, I'm not giving you these names and addresses of these people. They're protected. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that. And one of them yelled to me, who do you think runs this place? And I said, well, I do. And they said, no, you don't. We do. I said, well, that's a really big problem.
Welcome to the storm. I'm your host, Stuart Winchester. Back to a storm favorite today, and one of the most talked about ski areas in the country over the past couple of years, Gunstock, New Hampshire. Before we get there, a huge thank you to all of my paid subscribers to the Storm Skiing Journal and podcast. You are helping to ensure the future of independent ski journalism that is about more than stoke and bro culture. The Storm is a sustainable small business because of you, and I appreciate you all so very much. If you are still on the free tier and are considering an upgrade to paid, the benefits include access to podcasts 7 days early, plus 100% of all Storm Skiing Journal articles, past, present, and future. If you are just seeing the article previews right now, you are missing about 80% of the Storm's content. If you are not even on the free tier yet, you can sign up for that or upgrade to paid at stormskiing.com. You can also follow The Storm on the X platform or Instagram at Storm Ski Journal. Before we get to New Hampshire, a quick word from my sponsor, Profile Search International, the ski industry talent acquisition experts. You ever listen to this podcast and think, dang it, Stu, that person you're interviewing is brilliant, thoughtful, insightful, and funny. I wish I had someone like that running my ski area. Well, guess what? The team at Profile Search International has been placing great leaders, exactly like the ones that I interview, all over the world, from the Sierra Nevadas to the Alps to Alaska to the Andes for decades. They get it, and you can too. Think of Profile Search International as your expert boot fitter, but for talent. For 30 years, they have been obsessed with finding the perfect fit for your strategic hiring requirements. Like a great boot fitter, they don't just strap you into any old boots or skis. They find the perfect pairs. If you want to build strong, accountable, strategic teams with the support and expert guidance from Profile Search, just reach out to them at profilesearch.com or hit me up and I will send you the details you need. Go get the best talent for your special brands and places at profilesearch.com. Episode 168, Tom Day, President and General Manager of Gunstock, New Hampshire. Has any ski area in North America had a more eventful past 4 years than Gunstock, New Hampshire? Sure, just like everyone else, the ski area had to adapt to COVID operations in 2020. But just as things were getting back to normal in 2022, the ski area faced a rebellion from above. As the governing body that oversees the ski area, the Gunstock Area Commission, fell under the influence of a couple of goofballs enthralled to odd fringe ideologies. One of them, and I'm being serious with this, has pushed for New Hampshire to secede from the United States. So we're not dealing with normal actors here. The whole fiasco resulted in the resignation of Gunstock's entire senior management team, then their reinstatement just 12 days later. It was one of the odder episodes in the history of U.S. skiing, and it made national news, briefly making this mid-sized New Hampshire ski area into the biggest story in the sport. There was also, perhaps, no higher profile event in recent skiing history that better demonstrated the character and constitution of a ski industry leader. Had anyone else other than Tom Day been running Gunstock in the summer of 2022, I think we'd probably be looking at a very different ski area right now. So as Tom heads toward a very well-earned retirement, I wanted to get him in here to tell his whole story so we can all understand how, when the kooks came, he was ready. Let's go. My guest today has been president and general manager of Gunstock Mountain Resort in New Hampshire since 2020. Gunstock sits on 1,340 vertical feet and 227 acres of trails and glades, served by 8 lifts. Prior to taking the top job at Gunstock, he spent 32 years at Waterville Valley, New Hampshire, including 13 years as general manager. He recently announced that he would retire from Gunstock at the end of this ski season. He is also a very good friend of the Storm, making his second appearance on the Storm Skiing Podcast. Tom Day is my guest. Tom, welcome back to the Storm. Always a pleasure to connect with you. How's life today, Tom?
Hey, it's pretty good. Good to see you again, Stuart, and talk to you again. Things are going all right. You know, March has been a little less weather. The weather's been a little less than we like as far as temperatures and rainfall. But other than that, it's a sunny day. We've got a big event going on here, the Francis Pichet race. So there's 350 racers here. So there's a lot of activity going on with that project right now.
So we're recording this on March 14th. Typically, Gunstock, under your leadership, is aimed for first week in April to close. Is that the goal this year?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, provided it doesn't turn pouring rain, we should make it till April 7th. That's our date. I don't think we'll have a problem doing that. We still got a lot of terrain open. We still get some good coverage.
Fingers crossed you make it. It sounds like you're set up really well. But either way, this is the last time it's going to be your problem. I have to give you a huge congratulations here on your forthcoming retirement. Take us into your head here, Tom. What drove that decision? Why is now the right time for you to call it quits?
Well, I turned 70 in February. And I decided that things were going really well here. We've got a great staff. Our senior staff's great. Our management staff's great. Things were going really well, and I decided it was time for me to step back and enjoy myself while I'm still in relatively good shape and healthy. So I own a place in Park City, which where I'll spend the winter next winter, and I also have a place on an island in Maine, which I will spend the summers on. So I got some good spots to go, and my wife and I want to do some traveling. Two of my very close friends turned 70 this year, two guys I grew up with, and they're still very active. So the opportunity to go travel and enjoy ourselves. And I mean, if I was 65, I'd be here another 5 years. I've really enjoyed it, but it's time for me to sit back and kick back and totally take advantage of enjoying life.
Can you lay out some of that travel bucket list for us? Where do you want to go?
Well, you know, we've done quite a bit. We want to take a boat down the Rhine. That's something that we've wanted to do. You know, a couple of years ago, I went 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle with two of these buddies that I was talking about that I was skiing with out west. That was an interesting trip. But last year, we hiked in Scotland and Wales and then took a boat down the Caledonia Canal. The friend of mine brought his boat over from Norway, and we sailed the Caledonia Canal, which splits Scotland in half. So it was a lot of those cool things. These guys are all very adventurous. So it's traveling, hiking, boating. There's just a whole lot of things that we're planning on doing to make this retirement really work.
Are your buddies skiers? Is there any big ski areas that you haven't hit that you'd like to make sure that you do?
Yeah, these guys are the ones I went out to Sun Valley and Big Sky with. So,
oh, nice.
I don't know. We'll kind of look and see what we want to do. We're kind of thinking about Europe. It depends how the snowfall is doing some stuff in Europe or doing some of the skiing from huts to huts out that way. That sounds like it's a really fun idea to us, too. We were talking about that while we are out of Big Sky. So it's just where we think everyone thinks that they want to go that haven't been yet, but we just haven't really dug into it yet.
It sounds like you have a good plan, and it's a well-deserved break after decades and decades of hard work. Most of that career, and we discussed this last time you were on the podcast, was in skiing with about a 10-year break in there doing some other things. What's kept you mostly in skiing, Tom, for going on 50 years here?
I guess there's just something wrong with me. you're in the ski business, and you get to go to a lot of different skiers. It's a fun business. It's exciting. It's challenging. It's annoying. But there's also the opportunity to be outside, enjoy all that nature has to offer in the whatever part of the country you're from. You generally are people of like minds that are in this business, both your competitors or your neighboring ski areas, which, you know, I know all the GMs in New Hampshire because we're all in Ski New Hampshire. It's just a great way to kind of have a career that gets to do the things you love to do, and that's skiing and working with people. And you know, you have to enjoy being around people, because my theory is that 10% of everybody that comes to a ski area can be a little bit of a problem, and 90% of them are having a really good time, and it's the 10% you hear the most from. So it's dealing with those people, but then knowing that the other 90% are really enjoying everything. So it's just a fun business frustrating, but exciting and fun and challenging. And that's, I think, why we all do it.
Well, I have to say your last chapter might have been your most interesting for a lot of reasons that we can get into. I want to set it up first, though, in a broad way. Tom, if you can take us into Gunstock by the numbers. And I always like talking about Gunstock because everything's public, right? Whereas a lot of these companies, even Vail, that's a public company, doesn't really give you a lot. So when you arrived, to set this up for the listeners, the ski area actually required a bridge loan from Belknap County, which owns the ski area, to get through every summer. Now, Gunstock actually writes a check to the county every year. What did Gunstock look like when you arrived as far as skier visits, annual revenue, profit, season pass sales, and what do those numbers look like now, 4 years later?
The skier visits were around 170 or 180. The revenue was around 12 million, and now our revenue is 20 million, and our skier visits are about 220,000. So there was a significant uptick in the skier visits and in the, obviously based on that, on the revenue. And then we really focused on revenue per skier visit and eliminating a lot of discounting. There was a lot of discounting that occurred before, and we realized that we needed to try to get our revenue per skier visit up, because then we could have less skiers, a better experience for the skiers that are here, but make the same amount of money. So those are some of the things that we did, and the staff that was here, the senior people especially, they were ready to put the pedal to the metal, and we did. And of course, you know, COVID hit, and that sort of slowed the pedal a little bit. But all the things that happened during COVID as far as advanced ticket sales, online ticket sales, online rentals, this and that, I mean, we just kept it in place like a lot of places did. And all of a sudden, our revenues just started to climb substantially in the first year. So it was a matter of just tweaking a lot of things that were here and making it so that you made more money, and we limited ticket sales. And because of that, our season pass sales went up, pre-committed sales. So that's something that, you know, about 30% of our revenue that we generate is pre-committed sales right now. So that insulates you a little bit against a bad season.
220,000 skier visits. I'm looking right now at an article I wrote after you outlined the Gunstock's long-term master plan in December of 2021. And you said then that if you implemented this master plan, you could get to 240,000 skier visits. I mean, you haven't built, you haven't cut a single tree for this master plan, and you're already almost at that skier visit count. I mean, what accounts for this huge surge in popularity? Is it this COVID outdoor boom? Is it consolidation and people looking for an independent alternative? What, from your point of view, has made Gunstock such a booming business the last few years?
I think that we're, and you and I have talked about this before, I think we're not like any of the guys that have done the consolidation, which I, as we've talked about, I think they all have great business models. I think they run good businesses. Only we decided that we needed to be something that they weren't. And that's obviously a position you have to take when you're dealing with some conglomerate ski areas right down the road from you. So we just tried to make it more comfortable. Like I said, we limited ticket sales so that the lines aren't long. We have free bag check in the base lodge that you have to put your bags in, so the lodge wasn't as piled up with boots and skis, you know, stuff everywhere. What we tried to do, we worked on all the buildings. We really tried to spruce everything up that we have. We spent $12 million in the past 4 years on capital projects, and we haven't borrowed a dime. So we just really tried to make everything look really good, be comfortable, have the skier experience be very comfortable for them. You know, we're an intermediate mountain. We have some black diamond trails, but they're short. And I think the market that we cater to likes that, the families, the people that don't want to be in a crowded situation. And that's why I think that we've been able to continue to grow our skier visits. I mean, we're at 220. We've stayed at 220 for the past 3 years. Well, this year will be a little different, but I think people just like the fact that it's not overly busy, not overly crowded, and that we've really worked on everything that we can have to make it be very comfortable for the people that are here.
So on top of all that, Tom, my understanding in recent years is that you've been able to grow a nice little savings account that you can tap into. What's that number at today?
We have right now, and of course, this counts the pre-committed sales from the season passes that we just started selling, but we have about $8 million in the bank. And so that's something that is what we use. you know, you look at your EBITDA for what you want to do in capital expansion, and then you look at your what you have in your bank to be able to insulate you against a season like this. So we've got a lot of cash in the bank. We're looking at another $4 to $5 million worth of capital improvements this year. So it's an interesting ski area because where we're located is we draw from the New Hampshire and Maine seacoast. We draw from central New Hampshire, and we also draw from Massachusetts. And Lake Winnipesaukee, which you can see from the top of the mountain, has a lot of very wealthy, beautiful homes on the lakes, and those people are using those for winter homes too. So we have a real, the demographics are very interesting, and we just see a lot of generational skiers that have been coming here because it's kind of the neighborhood backyard ski area also. So I think that it kind of works. What our business plan is works for what we are. It wouldn't necessarily work for everybody, but it works for what we are with our geographical location and where we draw from.
And there's an important piece of that business plan that I'd like to get into a little bit here, Tom. And that's there's some misunderstanding in the general marketplace that because gun stock is publicly owned, it's also publicly subsidized, like the Orta ski areas in New York or like Cannon Mountain. The ski area, in fact, operates as a self-supporting entity. Can you just lay this out for us? How does gun stock function as a business, and how much does it actually return to the county each year?
So we're on county property, but we're a private business doing business as, it's called the Gunstock Area Commission, doing business as Gunstock Mountain Resort. And we have to pay 1.75% of our basically, well, kind of our net. So the first year I was here, we paid about $225,000. The next year we paid about $320,000. And last year we paid about $357,000. Not to be determined this year. So we don't take any money from the county. We have about $5 million worth of payroll, and about 68% of our employees live in Belknap County, which is the towns that surround the ski area. So we're a big generator, a revenue generator for the people that work here, but also we impact the hotels, restaurants, gas stations, retail sales, and rental sales around this area because in the winter, no one's on the lake. So we're a big part of the revenue production for everyone around here, plus all the staff that we have.
So it's a unique setup. It's also a real unique mountain with a very unique clientele, as you were laying out with all the folks that you draw from. What's always interesting to me about Gunstock is there's so many good ski areas in New Hampshire, and they're all so tight together that I'm always very interested in how people decide what to make their home mountain, because you have places like Loon and Bretton Woods that have invested so much money and they have such nice facilities. And yet Gunstock is this very vibrant place, and it's kind of a racer's mountain. It's kind of a family mountain. It's kind of a night ski mountain. It has all these different elements. From your point of view, as someone who's been in this industry for most of your career, what do you think makes Gunstock special, Tom? What have you enjoyed about it, and what sets this place apart from any other ski area that you've visited or worked at?
I mean, I think a lot of everyone at every skier thinks that there's, you know, a certain reason that when they're, if they're managing the ski resort, that people come there. I do think that the people that come here are a lot of families, which you know, there's plenty of other skiers, but they're all like really nice, and they really enjoy being here, and they have great attitudes, and you know, whenever you're, you know, I'm on the hill a lot because why be in the ski business if you don't ski? And when you ride up with people, there's just a positive vibe about stuff. We have done a lot, and we've made a lot of improvements, but there's just a positive vibe, and the people are very positive feeling about Gunstock, the people that ski and ride here. And you see it everywhere you go when you talk to people in the parking lot or whether you talk to them on the lift. It's kind of a little bit of a, I hate to say family, that sounds a little weird, but the people are just very supportive of Gunstock, what it's been done. But even not just because of all the things we've done in the past 4 years, they've been strong supporters of it for a long time. And like I say, you've got a lot of people that live right in the backyards of here. So you've got multi-generationals, but all ski areas have multi-generational people. So I don't know. It just seems like a really nice group of people that are here, that come here and participate in it. And I've been in other places, and you don't necessarily run into that really nice vibe.
You know, it's a really positive take on it, Tom. And I think that it would have been easy for you in particular to to grow cynical over the past 4 years. I'm not sure because I wasn't around in the 1930s, 40s, but if I had to bet, I would say this was probably the most challenging four-year period in the history of Gunstock Mountain Resort. You had the COVID pandemic, which kicked you in the butt a couple months after you started, and then this big thing with the Gunstock Area Commission, local politics in 2022, and we can get into that a little bit more in a minute. But as you survey this last 4 years, how did that compare to any challenges you may have had in your decades at Waterville Valley or elsewhere throughout your career?
Well, it was certainly different because you don't have an environment that got created with our little community relations issue anywhere else because you're running a private business owned by private companies or individuals. So the COVID thing, I mean, everyone got kicked in the butt with COVID. I certainly questioned the reason that I came back into the ski business because I started January 15th and March 15th, we were shut down because of COVID. And I went, you know, this was really a bad idea to get back into the business. This is really weird. And how bad can this pandemic be? Well, a little did I know. So, I mean, it's the challenge is everyone that's listening to this, everyone that operates a ski area, works at a ski area, you know, there's tons of challenges weather-wise. And you know, back when I was at Waterville, we were putting in detachable quads. We had the second detach in the east. Hunter put one in. We put one in. You know, there was a whole lot of changes that happened, but they were exciting changes. And you learned as you went about snowmaking and then detachable lifts and that kind of stuff. So there was challenges. They just were all kind of fun challenges that you learned a lot from here. Like I said, COVID was weird, but it was weird for everybody. And then our little community relations stuff, that was an odd little situation that you just don't have at a ski area.
So if I put a crystal ball in front of you on January 15th, 2020, do you walk out the door and say, who needs this? Or do you stick with it and just live the adventure?
Yeah, I'm kind of a stick with it kind of guy anyways. We had to furlough 50% of our staff. I'd been here, you know, 2 months, they didn't really even know who I was. And then I said, hey, how you guys doing? By the way, 50% of you are going to be furloughed and we'd love to have you come back. Yeah, so that was uncomfortable because, like I said, no one really knew me. So yeah, I certainly, like I said, I went, you got to be kidding me. What is a pandemic? And what do you do about it? And of course, like everyone else, I thought it was going to be gone in a month. And then it just got worse. And then, you know, you're doing meetings on Zooms and, you know, all trying to figure out what you're going to do. And Ski New Hampshire, we all, the GMs got together. And that's the other cool thing about this business is that all the GMs in New Hampshire, and I'm sure it's the same way in every state, you know, everyone worked together to come up with solutions for all the problems that the pandemic came up with. And how do we make this work? And what are you guys doing here? What are you guys doing with this? And we formed a task force to work with the state to figure out how we were going to be able to do things and still operate. But it was great because you all work together anyways in the ski business. I've seen it universally and certainly in New Hampshire. So it was cool to be able to sit and figure things out and say, how did this work? And what did you guys do? And come up with different ideas. And everyone was having the same problem. So it was a collaborative effort that really showed how well all the ski areas and individuals that are involved in the ski areas could work together to kind of overcome this issue.
And you did get through it. And in the summer of 2020 and the 2020-21 ski season, really interesting. And probably you thought that was going to be the defining event of your tenure. But then the summer of 2022 comes along and you and your senior leadership team resigned on July 20th of that year over a dispute with the Gunstock Area Commission. And you'd had a pretty good working relationship with them before. Tell us quickly for the listeners who may not be familiar what the Gunstock Area Commission is and how did the dynamic between you change that summer and how did it lead to your resignation?
Well, there's five commission members and they ultimately like the board of directors for the ski area. And they're supposed to have either, you know, some ski background, hospitality background, financial background. There were five guys that were, a couple of them, the ones that recruited me to come here. We have a meeting once a month. They take an hour and a half. We go through the financials. We talk about what we're doing capital wise and, you know, have discussions. They ask questions. And then we have a very weird political climate here in Belknap County. Mm-hmm. And the commissioners are appointed by, there's 19 delegates, the representatives of the state of New Hampshire. Now, New Hampshire has 400 members of the House of Representatives, the third largest in the world, England and India, with the other two countries. So you can get elected fairly easily because they pay $100 a year to be a representative. So there were a couple of representatives that were on the delegation that appoints the commission members. They started causing some problems. One of the guys was a free stater who sponsored a bill to have New Hampshire secede from the United States. So there's an idea of what that person's head is like. And so they ended up having two members resign on the commission, and they appointed two members of their like thought pattern, and they kind of took over the commission, and then they tried to convince us that we didn't know what we were doing, and they wanted personal phone numbers and addresses and email addresses for all of our staff. And I said, yeah, well, that's not happening. And they said, you can't tell us that. We're your boss. And I go, well, you know, I can. And then it got more contentious, and they wanted to, there was just a whole lot of things. They didn't like the fact that they didn't like that we were successful, that we had a lot of money in the bank. They thought that there was all kinds of malfeasance financially, and they just made all kinds of accusations. The meetings went from an hour and a half to 5 hours. There would be like usually five people at the meeting. By the end of these meetings, after about 3 months, there would be 70 to 100 people in the room, most of employees and supporters of Gunstock. And we would just have these large, well, they would yell and scream. I would just sit there and say, well, no, that's not right. And you don't really know what you're talking about. And then they had one particular meeting right before I resigned when I said, I'm not giving you these names and addresses of these people. They're protected. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that. And one of them yelled to me, who do you think runs this place? Who do you think runs the ski area? And I said, well, I do. And they said, no, you don't. We do. I said, well, that's a really big problem. And so it just got worse and worse. And then we came back to a meeting. We used to sit at the table with them and discuss stuff around, you know, on a round table. And then we came in one night and they had us all sitting in the audience. And if we wanted to speak, we would have had to raise our hand and then go up to a table and speak into the microphone to address things. And that we were questioning whether we were going to continue to put up with it. And I said, you know, maybe they'll change. So they didn't. And once we were sitting in the audience, I raised my hand and said, can you tell me why we're sitting here? And they said, well, we think it's better controlled, because they didn't like the fact that we were speaking to them negatively. And they said, we think it's better controlled this way. And I said, well, then I tell you what, you guys obviously don't think you need me. You know more than I do. So good luck. I'm giving my resignation, and I'll give you 2 weeks notice to help you square things away. And, you know, you think you know a lot about the ski business. So I'm going to resign. And then my CFO stood up and she resigned. And my HR director stood up and she resigned. The snow sports director, he resigned. The director of resort services resigned. And our director of facilities resigned. So all the senior managers, people resigned and walked out. So that was an interesting time. And we all went to a local bar and had a couple of beers and talked about it.
And you can watch that online. It was a remarkable scene and showed a lot of courage on your part and on your team's part. You know, spoiler alert here, 12 days later, you were reinstated. The Belknap County delegation removed the problematic commissioners, David Strang and Peter Ness. Well, actually, one of them resigned and one of them, they removed. And so you came back. But none of that was inevitable, right? And I was not at all confident when you resigned that it would have the outcome that it did. In fact, I thought we were about to see an experiment and extreme fundamentalists trying to run a ski area because they don't think the public should own it or whatever. I just thought it was going to be a mess. Didn't end up that way. When you stood up on July 20th, 2022 and gave your resignation, could you have seen this outcome, the public support that surrounded you, the way that the system actually worked in your favor and you were able to win this particular battle?
No. I mean, I figured we were done. And I mean, realistically, it was my senior staff. I mean, these are people, I mean, I'm older, you know, so if I was done, I was done. And there's people that have worked here for 25 years, 30 years. It was two husband and wife team that have their whole livelihood came from here. You know, our HR person had been here 10 years. Our snow sports director had been here 4 years. It was just a huge, for them to walk out the door and to be in solidarity, because if they hadn't walked out and I walked out, it wouldn't have had the same results, because they were hoping I was going to quit. those two, the two nitwits, as you put down when they when you talked about the nitwits that tried to take over Gunstock. So no, we didn't think any of us were going to come back. Fortunately, the nitwits thought they had like a Rolodex of people they were going to call to come take all these jobs. And they're just, first off, they didn't know anybody. Secondly, anyone that they called would not have anything to do with it because they knew what was going on. And you know a lot of people in the business. And in fact, one person that they called that ended up contacting me said, I said, you know, a lot of times they give you a lot of rope when you get a new job. Well, this rope you can hang yourself with. So after two or three days talking to the staff was less than cooperative, a lot of the staff, when they were telling them that, you know, this is a good thing and this is going to happen and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, we didn't think we were coming back, but it just became obvious. And then there was a huge amount of support from the community. When they said, will you guys come back? I said, we'll come back if Strang and Ness are gone. Other than that, we're not coming back. So that became a little bit of an issue, but the community was amazing. 250 people showed up at the lodge, packed it the day that they were going to vote to get rid of those two. And they were very vocal. That's also online. And it was like the Lord of the Flies in there. And the people were screaming and yelling and pounding on the windows. And it was like unbelievable. So the support of the community was a huge part of what happened that was positive. And so, you know, like you said, I think 12 days later, we came back. We didn't think that was going to happen, but the community really they were adamantly opposed to what had happened. And it was a huge support for all of us. It felt pretty nice to see them there supporting us and that all of the staff got to come back.
You said something to me in that 2 weeks, we talked a little bit in between when you resigned and when you were reinstated. And one thing you said stuck out to me, and I've never forgotten this. You said, winter comes awful fast for people in the ski business, a lot faster than it comes for normal people. When we go back to this, it was just 12 days, but yet it was one of the biggest stories in skiing. And I think they realized pretty quick that this ski area was not going to have much of a future without people who actually knew what they were doing and an experienced team. We're still talking about this almost 2 years later. How disruptive was this, Tom, this 12-day episode, long-term to Gunstock's operations? Is it just a crazy story, or did this really impact the ski area in ways you're still feeling today?
No, I think it had more of an effect on our staff that stayed here. I think they were the ones that kind of took the brunt of it, really. And then we came back in and it was, you know, there was a lot to do there was a lot of having to talk to everybody and say, hey, geez, you know, we're back. And I know that this was horrible and thank you for pulling in and doing what you did and keeping things rolling. But it wasn't disruptive. It's funny that you say that because you come back and then all of a sudden there was Soul Fest, which was this Christian festival that we had. We don't have it anymore because we lost money on it, but we had to come back. The guys that had run that had to get that ready. There was, you know, 7,000 people come to it. But then we got rolling into winter, like we talked about. You know, winter starts in basically mid-September. You got to get ready to roll. I call it Alzheimer's disease. Everyone seems to forget that every year you have to open again and that, you know, everything has to be ready to run. And then we got rolling in the ski business, and anyone that listens to this knows, once you get rolling in the ski business, you're kind of just rolling. Your focus is on getting snow made and getting trails open and getting to where you can get around the mountain when you have a way to the top to the bottom. And so by the time we got rolling, it was in the middle of January, and I'd be on a lift and people would say, hey, Jesus, it's nice to see you're still here. It kind of had been this distant thing, you know, like right. It happened, but, you know, and I go, I wonder what they mean by that. And I'm like, oh yeah, no, I know what you mean. So it just was a weird, it was really weird. And then it was just not weird anymore. And we got back into running a ski area and those guys were gone. So no, it didn't. It was just weird. And all of a sudden, by the end of the winter, you kind of was a year to the date when we walked out, we went back to the same bar and sat down and drank more beers and talked about the past year and what happened and, you know, and some of the nitwits. But, this is the business. You get into it and you just get in gear and you're rolling and you just freaking forget about everything else but getting it rolling and running it.
So you got a lot of attention for a couple of weeks. And then I think Gunstock just sort of faded back in like it always does. It was just another mid-sized ski area. up in New Hampshire, whereas for a couple of weeks you were national news. That's my way of saying that I haven't been super locked into all the commission meetings and all the things that have happened since then. When you look at the conflict between Ness and Strang and management, it seemed to go back to some language from the 1959 charter that established the Gunstock Area Commission, which stated that the body, quote, had the responsibility of managing, end quote, the ski area. And it was a little bit ambiguous, and that's where they were interpreting that as we run the ski area. Has this language been amended in any way to clarify that the GAC's responsibility is to hire a professional management team, which they do, and support them? Or have any other changes been made to clarify the roles of the commission versus the roles of the general manager and the other senior staff?
They haven't changed it, but there's been a couple of some policies and procedures put into place that the new commissioner put in that were like an addendum to that, that basically says if the commission has to deal with any personnel issues or anything like that, it goes through the general manager. And then the general manager facilitates dealing with these people. Because what these guys wanted is they wanted to eliminate me and be able to go and dive into all the staff and try to poison them with their bizarro thoughts. So yeah, there was some other things put in place, and not saying that they couldn't be two more crazies put on the commission at some point, but some of the language that they put in place after that really protects that from happening. And so I think that everyone's pretty comfortable, and the new commission's great. My meetings last an hour and a half. Once a month, there's great discussions about what we do. They're supportive of the ideas that we have. They're skiers. They're happy to be out on the hill skiing. And so yeah, I think that was a one-off. I can't just ever see it happening again, and it hadn't happened in the 40 years prior to that.
What I could never figure out, Tom, and maybe you have some insight on this since you were so close to it, is they pay you a pretty nice salary to run the ski area, and that's all public record. The commissioners themselves earn, I want to say, $25 a month or $25 a meeting or something like that. So basically, you know, enough to gas up your car to get there and back. What was their motivation? Because this wasn't some sort of power play that was going to enrich them. It seemed to be more ideologically driven. And what was behind all this?
I could never figure it out. they seemed to think that we were running like wild horses through here and spending money and taking money and doing what we wanted. And they froze our capital the first year they got in there. They didn't even know what we were doing. We spent half of it anyways. So in fact, we kind of actually kept spending it because we had a couple of projects that were done and hoped that they didn't catch it, which they couldn't read a balance sheet anyway, so it didn't matter. And I don't know. To this day, I can't figure out what they wanted to do other than they wanted to put somebody in my position, I think, that they could totally control. And then because we have a lot of money in the bank, a year later, they put a house bill in to try to control our budget, that the delegation would control the budget. It got slammed shut down. They just put another one in to try to up our 1.75 to 3% of what we give them and to have a forensic audit done, where you look at every check. We write 4,000 checks. It costs $150,000. We have an audit done every year, and then they wanted to make sure all the meetings were recorded, which to show you how bright they are all recorded anyways. So it went to the House Municipal Committee. There's 20 people on that. We had to go testify again. We testified the last one that got shot down. We had to testify in this one. They're just basically time bandits, and it got killed again. So, I mean, they just keep coming back. And the good thing, too, is a bunch of them didn't get reelected. When we did this stuff, they formed this Belknap Citizens, Concerned Belknap Citizens, and they put together a voting guide that they passed out at every town in Belknap County to tell you who not to vote for and who to vote for. So four of them got voted out. But there's still a few left that keep trying to get their hooks in the Gunstock. And I don't know why they do it. It just amazes me. I listen to that testimony and I just shake my head. You're not supposed to grin in those things. I have trouble not grinning when they talk because it's just so stupid. And then one of the guys that didn't get reelected, who was the chairman of the Belknap County delegation, he was very angry. He just got up there and testified about how awful I was and that I was retiring, thank God, and just, you know, that I do whatever I want. I run the place however I want and we waste money. And he went on a tear. He did the worst that anyone could have done for them as far as this, because all the the 20 people on the House Municipal Committee are staring at him going, who's this guy? So, so yeah, I don't know. They're just, they're kind of a little bit off center, and they seem to have an agenda about gun stock, and I don't get what it is, but once I'm not working anymore here, I can say whatever I want.
You know, part of it, Tom, there's always been this undercurrent of suspicion of government ownership of really anything. But I think the fact the local government owns the ski area really seems to bother some people. And a lot of them backed away from that. The politicians in the Belknap County Commission during this whole fiasco, Norm Silber was still suggesting it. And I think that might be the guy you're talking about who didn't get reelected, but that idea is out of favor. However, I'll play devil's advocate for a moment. Most ski areas are privately run and they don't have to deal with this stuff, right? So would gun stock be better off if they either sold it or leased it to someone like Vail, who runs Mount Sunapee, the state-owned ski area?
Yeah, they can't. When that was being discussed and it got really looked into, and it would have to be voted by the entire House of Representatives in the state of New Hampshire. So it really can't be. I don't think so. And so it can't really be leased or sold, but I don't think so. It's like the normal people are back. There was normal people 40 years before that ran it because they get $25 a meeting. So there's one meeting a month. So I don't think there's any reason too. It just was some people that were like, had a weird thing. I mean, they're still doing something. There's a weird kind of post that they have here, and they posted a picture of a letter that I sent that I used the postage machine at work to send a personal letter for 60 cents. And that was the big reason now that they should have a fiscal audit, because I'm now misusing the stamp machine at work. For 60 cents. So they're still around, but no, it's fine like it is. You just ignore them because they're not worth having any thought patterns about.
So it's not going to be your problem much longer. However, the ski area will need a new general manager. Curious how involved you are, if at all, in that process, Tom, and what characteristics you're looking for in the next general manager of gun stock, because I don't think this is a job for a young guy in the up and come. I think it really calls for someone super experienced, but that's my take from the outside. What are you involved and what are you looking for?
Well, first off, they have to be as good looking as I am.
High bar.
Or I think they really have to be good looking. No, I'm very involved in it. The commission's great. There's two members of the commission that are involved will be involved in the interviewing process, myself and three of my senior managers. So there'll be five people on the interview. We've got a company that's doing a search that looks for upper level ski area operators. And we've had some very good results so far. We haven't interviewed anyone yet, but we've had some good results. So I'm very involved in it. The commission's very involved in it. They understand. The commission's extremely supportive of what's happened here, and they realize that it's important that myself and the senior team are comfortable with who comes in here and takes my place, and that they need to understand that because it is county owned, it's a little different. And anyone that's going to take a job here is going to Google this place, and if they didn't hear about what happened, they're going to go, oh, geez, is that going to happen again? So we're very involved in it. I think it's a mid-sized skier, as you said. It makes a bunch of money. So it's got to be someone that recognizes too that the senior staff here are very strong. They've been incredible with all the changes that we've done. They've been 100% behind it. In fact, started driving it after a while. So it just has to be someone that fits in right and understands what gun stock is. And I think there's some people out there that we're looking at now that I think would fit in well. And once we talk to them, and the good thing is that, I've been around the business a long time. If I don't know them, I'm going to know somebody that knows them. So that helps a lot too. So I'm very optimistic that we'll find the right person that comes in here, and anyone looks at the balance sheet is going to go, oh, geez, that's not a bad place to come work. So I'm very optimistic that they'll find the right person, and probably, hopefully, by the time we get into May or June, there'll be somebody else sitting at this desk.
You set the bar kind of high with that statement you made when you resigned on July 20th. And I really thought, sincerely, that was a remarkable act of courage by you and your team. And that's not a word you hear a lot in the ski business, but it really takes a certain kind of person to be able to do that. And I think a lot of that was your 45 years of experience speaking and just having the confidence of a longtime leader. As you look back on your career, Tom, I don't know, maybe you would have done that when you were 22, but I don't know, who were the folks you worked with, or maybe this was a family trait and something you learned growing up, but who were your mentors, your influences, who prepared you for that moment and to be able to take that stand in a very delicate situation?
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, you sent me some questions and that was one of them. First off, you know, my father was a big believer in honesty, integrity, and respect. And that's how I try to live my life with the people that I work with, the people that I interact with, the friends that I have. And I think that's what those guys didn't have. And that's what really bothered me. But as far as the, you know, it's funny. I thought about that when you said that. I look back because, you know, I was at Waterville for 32 years and I thought there's a lift attendant. I think rather than the people that I honestly really gave that some thought. And I almost think that I always kind of had my own thoughts on how things should be. And when I was a mountain ops guy, I knew I wanted to be the GM at some point. I think it's almost that I looked at the people that I worked for that, especially the GMs, because we went through a lot of GMs at Waterville because we changed hands twice, actually three times it was sold. And I think I looked at some of the guys that I had as GMs and I looked at all their bad traits and decided I didn't want to be that. So it's almost like I formed my self-worth or self-opinion of what I needed to be by looking at all the things I didn't want to be. And that sounds weird because everyone says they have a mentor. And I don't want to sound like I'm like I didn't have a mentor. I don't really think I did. There was just so many GMs that came and went, and some of them had some good traits, some of them had some bad traits. But I just looked at stuff I didn't want to be, and I didn't want to ever treat the staff the way that I saw some of them treat the staff, the senior people, and the management. And so I think that's kind of how I became my business philosophy or my human being philosophy or whatever you want to call it. I think it was based on all the things I didn't want to be.
Yeah, it all came together at the right time. You know, looking back, Tom, one of the big contentious issues, this also confused me. I wasn't sure why it was so contentious because every scary has a master plan. But it was this master plan that Gunstock had put out, like I said, in December of 2021. And it was pretty much your standard. I mean, it was a pretty ambitious plan. But it laid out some goals for the next several years. There would have been three new terrain pods, one on Weeks on the backside, on the east side, and on Alpine Ridge, where there's that lost ski area. It would have upgraded the Ramrod and Tiger lifts and the Penny Patou lift. You were considering a summit lodge and a hotel. And you laid this all out, and this was controversial with the GAC, and they just couldn't wrap their brains around why you would need to do this. Anyway, that kind of got put on hold, and you said they were messing with your capital a little bit. 2.5 years later, where are we at with this master plan? Is the plan that you outlined in December 2021 still substantively what you're working with here?
Well, actually, the current commission wants to now do a workshop to take a look at what was rolled out. And the reality of it is that when the existing commission wanted to roll it out with some of the existing commissioners, it was a very ambitious plan because we didn't own any of the land on the backside, and I didn't see anywhere that they were going to let it happen. It was in conservation property. The Alpine Ridge development, it didn't make a whole lot of sense because it's not hooked to the ski area. So there's one, the east side was the only one that made any sense, and that's the one that's to the left of Pistol Lift. So what the current commission wants to do is take a look at that as a working project and say what really makes sense to potentially do here, and then put a number to it because, you know, we don't get any steeper, we get wider. And, you know, you need to, you know, like I said, we're at 220,000 skier visits. They were saying that you need to get to 220 or 240 to be able to afford this expansion, especially on the east side. So it's really looking at it and what the real financial impact is of doing it. And do we actually add that many more skier visits, or do you get curiosity seekers coming to look at it and then they don't do anything with it? So what we're doing this year is what I was encouraging is that we tweak what we have. So we have two trails that we don't have snowmaking on, Hot Shot, which is a cool trail, and this other trail called Ramrod Race, Upper Ramrod, which is an old lift line, but it doesn't have any end to it. Like at the end of it, when you have natural snow, you got to hook a left and herringbone out. So we're hooking that into another trail, we're putting snowmaking on both of those this year. And we're going to kind of keep tweaking what we have here to make it that much better. And then take a look with the study committee at what the realities of that east side pod and that master plan.
So it sounds like what you're saying, Tom, is that you anticipate that the backside weeks expansion and the Alpine Ridge expansion that were outlined in that master plan, that you don't really think there's any realistic chance of those happening.
No, the backside of weeks, you're never going to get that permitted. And we own the Alpine Ridge, the old Alpine Ridge ski area, we own it, but it doesn't make any sense because you're creating almost a separate ski area that has a link to it by a trail. And it just doesn't have the kind of terrain that you need to do. That's why it's no longer a ski area.
What's changed between now and 2021 when you published this plan as far as that understanding? Because this was all something that you laid out in one of the public meetings and went through a pod by pod. Do you just have a different understanding of it now, or were there other forces at work then that included these things that maybe shouldn't have been included at all?
I think potentially there was a little overzealous enthusiasm for this huge development here, because I don't think financially you could have ever done it and made it work anyways. But I think that the rollout probably should have been a lot more well thought out than it was before we rolled out this whole thing. And that's generally what you do when you do a master plan. And we work with SE Group, and I've worked with them for years. And you kind of look at stuff and then you say, well, you know what? This one doesn't make sense. And this one doesn't make sense. So let's go with these two. So I think there was a little more over enthusiasm about rolling it out without having given it a lot of thought.
Nonetheless, the third terrain pod would be a substantial expansion for Gunstock. So it'd be really fun to see that. Are you still thinking that Gunstock could see a hotel and or a summit lodge? Where's your head on those two pieces?
Summit lodge, I doubt it, because it just isn't there isn't a room to put it up there. And the hotel seems to be a kind of a little bit of a lightning rod. People either love it or hate it. And there's nobody in between. And I think they're split 50-50. So, you know, that seems to be really a, you know, someone either tells me, how come you haven't built a hotel? Or someone tells me, I can't believe you think you built a hotel. So it seems like that seems to be something that would be, if we wanted to do the other pod, that might be something that would really cause a lot of issues again.
So Gunstock may be better off long-term as a day ski area that people drive to, it sounds like.
I think that if there was a hotel here, it would help finance the extra expansion. I think it would be necessary to have it. But once again, you get people riled up around here and all of a sudden you got the 50-50 and depends which 50 is louder.
All right. So one project you were able to move ahead with, which is great, but also a little bit funny, is that you paved the parking lot last year. And that was a big deal. And, you know, if you drive to Walmart and the parking lot isn't paved, you would be like, what is wrong with this place? But I started thinking about it and realized that most ski area parking lots, even in 2024, are not paved. So why was it such a big deal for Gunstock to pave the parking lot? And how much easier has that made your life as far as just not having mud everywhere and plowing and everything else?
Well, I mean, just so that everyone listens knows, we got the money from the American Rescue Plan that was put into place. And Belknap County got $11 or $12 million. So everyone put in requests for things that they wanted to do with it. And we put in a request that we wanted to pave the parking lot. And it took a couple of years, but all of a sudden we got the request granted. The delegation voted to approve it. And they gave us $1.3 million to pave our parking lot. Without having gotten that money from the county, I don't think our parking lot would be paved. It is, as odd as it sounds, it is amazing the difference with a parking lot. And right. Because we have night skiing 5 nights a week. We have, you know, 22 trails open at night, five lifts. The lighting, before people, we'd have these portable lights out there and people would be going back to their car and they'd be hitting the button on their remote trying to get their lights to flash. And you'd see some kid with their mother and a couple of kids. It was like they won Megabucks when their lights turned on. There's a car. It's over there. So it's just unbelievable. It really is. And it's funny when I go to another ski area and I'm bouncing through their parking lot, I'm going, oh my God, our parking lot looked like this a year ago. So ridiculously beautiful. It's paved, it's lined. We have two parking lot attendants out there in the morning instead of, you know, seven. And they pull in, it stops the road, the traffic from backing up on the road, because they just pull in and they're in their lined spaces. We picked up another 80 or 85 lots, spaces for it.
Oh, nice.
It's just amazing. You know what the funniest thing is that people come up to me and go, you need to put numbers on the poles because I can't find my car. And okay. I go, and they're season pass holders.
Okay.
And I go, how did you find your car the past 5 years when it was here? And then they look at me like, I don't know. But I've had people come up to me and tell me they can't find the car because they don't have numbers on the poles.
That's so amazing.
So anyways, it makes a huge difference. It's unbelievable. It's clean. It keeps the lodge cleaner. It's easy to plow. Everything you can think of in a parking lot in this ski area. But there's a reason nobody has one, because no one's going to spend $1.5 million, $1.3 million to pave their parking lot.
Right. Well, it's a good last act, and you're leaving Gunstock in really good shape financially and from an infrastructure point of view. I want to rewind the tape here, Tom, and get your perspective as someone who's been around and seen the entire evolution of this industry. I know you started working in skiing in 1978, and we can talk about that, and we have talked about that in the past, but actually, how long have you been skiing? If you can indulge me on that. What are your earliest memories? Where did you start?
Actually, I grew up in Maine, in Falmouth, Maine, right outside of Portland. And my best friend, the one who I sailed past the Arctic Circle with, his parents had something, grandparents had something to do with Sunday River. So back when I was 10 years old or 8 years old, we started skiing there. But we also had a little ski area in town called Hurricane Mountain, and it was a rope tow, the terrifying rope tow. And it had one little steep pitch on the rope tow, and you'd hang on for dear life, because if you fell off there, you'd take everybody off behind you. And so that's where we all went on, you know, if we didn't go to Sunday River, we were all over there on the weekends, grabbing onto the rope tow, ripping your gloves off, flying up that hill. And that was what I did. But my friend, his family were going to Sunday River on weekends, so I went with them. And that's sort of what I remember, is being at Sunday River long before it was, you know, Sunday River. That was in 64 or 65. It was even earlier, 62, 63. So that's kind of how I got rolling.
Yeah, tell us about Sunday River in those days, because this was pre-Les Otten and all the development. And if you look at early era maps from Sunday River, you wouldn't recognize the place. I mean, it was like Mount Abram. It was just very small. It was just Barker. I think it might even have been a T-bar. Tell us about skiing at Sunday River before it was the Sunday River that we're all thinking of now.
Yeah, I had a little lodge. You know, it looked like, you know, any little ski area that, like you said, Lost Valley or Mount Abrams or whatever, that's what it looked like. And, you know, there was a chair. I do remember a T-bar. I remember that the lodge was busy. I remember that I really wanted a pair of ski pants, because back in those days, you skied in blue jeans. Right. And so my father got me, my parents didn't ski. And so he said, well, if you need ski pants, let's go get ski pants. That was a huge, huge, big deal for me the day I got my ski pants on. But it was tiny. It was little, and we were little, and it just was a lot of people around. It was just nothing.
So it was a different sort of skiing than what we think of today. And it hadn't changed a whole lot when you actually got into the industry in 1978. And we're talking about fixed grip double chairs everywhere, wicket tickets, really primitive snowmaking. The world you're leaving, you have high speed lifts, you have RFID, you have the super efficient snowmaking. I mean, the future sort of arrives in slow motion, and we don't really think about it day to day. But could you ever imagine this world, Tom, 50 years ago?
No. I mean, I remember when I was a lift attendant at Waterville, there was a White Peaks double went to the top. That was the main lift. And you used to put out the signs that were on steel pipe, and you put it in, and it would be 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, and 45 minute line signs for the lines.
Oh, wow.
And you would be, and on a busy day, the line to get on the lift would be 45 minutes long. And then they'd be like, well, don't put out the 45-minute sign. Just put out the 30-minute sign, because we don't want them to know they've been in there for 45 minutes. And I'm like, well, they're probably going to figure it out when it takes them 10 minutes to get to the 30-minute sign, but whatever. So, that's what I remember, is people waited in line. And the lift went 500 feet a minute. And They waited in line 35, 40 minutes. And no one in the world would put up with that now. They'd complain if they waited in line 7 minutes. So that's what I remember, putting those signs out and thinking, oh my God, you know, this is what's happening. I never thought that. I'm not a forward thinker. I didn't never thought we'd have high speed detachable lifts. It's an interesting evolution, and it's still the same people. It's just they're less patient.
Not only has the infrastructure gotten better, pretty much every piece of skiing is better. Better skis, better gear. Cars are better. We have GPS. It's funny. I remember driving around in the 90s, following back roads to try to find these ski areas. And now I can be in Wisconsin or wherever and just plug in a random thing and find it. So the whole experience of getting to navigating around ski areas has improved. And I think nostalgia shines brightly sometimes, but in reality, as we go along, things do tend to get better. But I want your take on it. I mean, do you think skiing is better in most ways, or some ways at least, than it was when you started?
Oh yeah, I mean, yes, yeah, because you know, no one has rock skis anymore. I mean, you used to open on fast grass, and you had rock skis for the early season because you beat the shit out of every pair of skis you had. So you had rock skis, and you know, snowmaking makes everything perfect, and high speed lifts. No, I think it's been a huge improvement, and the surface and the product is much better, and it's evolved the right way. It does make people less patient than they used to be, but still, everyone's out here having a good time. I love it on the weekends when it's busy and I stand in line and ride up with people and talk about stuff and how much fun they're having, and the kids are with them, or the kids are getting older now, so they don't ski with them anymore. And it's like when I was a kid, like I said, my parents didn't ski, but my father would say, well, let's go skiing. And he drove Buicks, those gigantic old Buicks. And and no one thought about all-wheel drive, four-wheel drive. So he'd say, let's get as many kids as we can in the back seat to go skiing so that it'll load the car down. And he'd get off to freaking Sunday River or drop us off or Sugarloaf. And you'd be in this, you know, big old Buick LeSabre with 10 kids in the back seat yelling and screaming, and off you go and, you know, plow your way through a snowstorm. So it's just gotten easier to do what we do now. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And that's really a good thing.
You know, it's a great story and it's a great visual, but no one would do that today, right? You wouldn't have 10 kids in a car with no seatbelts or drive your rear-wheel drive into a snowstorm or I mean, maybe you would, but.
No, you're right. You would never know. There are people, you know, I mean, now you see people in these gigantic Suburbans and they're leaving early. I go, why are you leaving early? Well, it's supposed to snow on our way home.
Yeah.
Well, I think he can make it through in this thing. It's off the tank. But they wouldn't do. I was joking with some friends of mine about that, with my father doing that stuff. And yeah, I mean, it would be snowing sideways. And I still remember too, you used to put these at the gas stations, you get these orange styrofoam balls to put on the antenna of your car, because mm-hmm. the snow bankings are so high. That's how you could see somebody when they were coming out of the road. And so my father put his little orange ball on and off we go. And you blinding snowstorm would take 3 hours to get somewhere to take an hour. And it didn't bother him the slightest.
It's an amazing story. And I bring it up not to question your father's parenting abilities, because that was a common thing back then, but more to ask this question. What, if anything, from your point of view, Tom, has skiing lost culturally over the decades? A lot of things have gotten better, obviously, but is there something that maybe it's hard to describe, but something that's missing that used to be part of the experience culturally?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, families are still here with their kids. The kids are having a great time. The family's having a good time. You have multiple age groups, you know, the 30-year-old, the 40-year-old, the 50-year-old, the 60-year-old, the 70-year-old. They're all out having, people are doing it. They're still having a great time. You know, the skiing's better. The skis are better. I don't think there's anything missing. I mean, except, you know, like I said, my father would have a butt hanging out of his mouth and we'd be in the back seat of the car and those seat belts, smoke flying through the air. I think the ski industry is a wonderful business. I think skiing is a wonderful thing for people and families that want to be outside. I still see all these kids that are here. There's 350 of them with their families here. They're having a ball. I think it's great. I don't think it's changed. It's just, evolved, and evolution is good. I'm a big believer in things should just get better.
And they are changing, and you've had a front row seat. You arrived at Gunstock shortly after Vail really came into the region in force and Alterra launched their Icon Pass. And what those two Colorado-based companies have brought with them east is their business model, meaning very high walk-up lift tickets. So you're looking at peak day lift tickets at or above $200 at Killington, Sugarbush, Stratton, Stowe. And then the other side of it, the Northeast Epic Pass, which accesses all of Vail's ski areas in New England and some beyond, is actually less than Gunstock's single mountain season pass. It's $600 to your $615. As you've had time to process all this and watch all this and compete against this, what's your outlook long-term for New England skiing, Tom, and all of this consolidation and the advent of these mega passes? And, you know, I think there's good things and I think there's some things that are more challenging, but what's been your observation and how do you think this plays out in the long term?
I don't know. You know, I mean, it seems to be working for them. I mean, there's some overcrowding issues. And of course, you know, anyone's going to take a picture at Vail when the back bowls are closed, so the line's 8 miles long on the other lifts. I don't know. I think the Vail Pass or the Alterra Pass, it gets people to go, they buy them and then they go out west and they ski Park City or they ski Big Sky or they, you know, they go places that gives them an opportunity to go do it. So I don't know. I think they have to be careful of kind of how they continue to grow their product, but obviously it works for them. And yeah, and it's driving people to buy season passes instead of day tickets because it obviously makes more sense to do that. I don't think it's going to hurt Gunstock. I think there's always going to be room for that smaller skier as long as you're well run and you create a good product and you continue to invest in your area. I think there's always the place, there's the people that don't want to be part of the mega pass. But, you know, it's like anything else. It gives people a lot of opportunities to go ski other places if they've got the money to go out west and you got the money to buy the $19 hamburger, you're all set. You know, you can get out there and do it. And so I don't see anything. I don't know. I know a lot of people doom and gloom, and I personally think whatever gets people on the snow and gets them skiing is good.
We've seen, given the skier visit numbers that you gave us earlier, and I believe your season pass sales are up. I interviewed Bridget Levansky, who runs Sugar Bowl out in California, out in Tahoe earlier this week. And she said Sugar Bowl's had a really hard time competing against Epic and Icon. And if you look at where they are, they have Palisades, Tahoe, and the Icon Pass just to their south. And then just to their east, they have North Star. And obviously, Vail has some other properties around Tahoe as well. It seems like Gunstock has really done well, even though there are so many Epic and Icon Pass mountains in New England that you're competing directly against. And those passes are very affordable compared to Gunstock passes. How have you been able to do this, Tom? What sort of advice would you give to other independent operators that are having a hard time competing against these passes and are thinking of maybe joining them because they can't beat them?
I guess maybe when you have more of them in your neighborhood than we do, then maybe it's more difficult to compete with them. But I don't think you can compete with them. You need to be what they aren't. And that then you can set yourself up to be successful. You can't compete with them. You can't compete with the capital that they have. You can't compete with the revenues that they make. You can't compete with all the chairlifts that they put in everywhere all the time. But it could be way more difficult where they are because there's just so many around them. So I don't know. What we did here business plan wise to not be them worked for us. I guess that's all I can say, but maybe it doesn't work for everybody.
And how did you make sure that you were not them?
By limiting ticket sales, by making sure that the experience when they get here is comfortable, by making sure our lines aren't long, by making sure the lodge isn't a packed mess. You know, it's just all the things that we wanted to do that kind of did what they don't do. Not saying that they, as once I said, they've got a good business plan. They make a ton of money. They build, you know, multi-million dollar lifts all over the place. There's nothing wrong with what they do. We just tried to do everything we tried to not be anything they were.
So between the numbers at Gunstock and nationally, we've seen skier visits post records for the last two winters in the United States, according to the National Ski Areas Association. As you look around, Tom, what do you think this was? Was it just a special moment in history where we kind of had this COVID outdoor boom? Was it these multi-mountain passes? Was it just good weather luck? I think I would be shocked if they weren't down substantially this year, secure visit numbers, just given the patterns I'm seeing all over the country. But as you observe skiing as a whole over the past couple of years, what do you attribute this growth to?
I think the pandemic did get a lot more people out that they weren't out before. Like our night visits during the pandemic were crazy. I mean, we sell out at 600. We were selling out all the time. And we still see quite a few people come skiing at night. But I think people got outside and realized that it's a great sport to have. If you're going to live in New England or anywhere that's snow on the ground, you ought to do something. If you're not ski-mobiling, you ought to be skiing. And I think that's why the people got back out again and realized it's a great sport. And if it's affordable, if you can buy a cheap, inexpensive mega pass, it's affordable. Pass holders generally don't eat here, or they don't take lessons, and they don't, they come, they ski, they're on the first chair, and they're leaving by 11:30 or 12 o'clock, depends on what the conditions are like. So I don't know. I think the pandemic got people outside again, and they realized that it was a cool, fun thing to do. And if you've got your family with you, it's a great way to be together, even if you're only meeting for lunch or you're just to ride up together. So I don't know. What did it? It's a great sport. And I think people understood that it's worth being outside, having a good time, and just dress for it. You're in the East. It's a lot different, although it wasn't warm in Big Sky. I don't know. I think people just realize that they should be outside and that people want to be healthy. People want to be healthy. People want to be healthy. However, the biggest thing we sell in our base lodge is chicken tenders. But people do want to be out and enjoy the outdoors. And I think that's it to me, but I don't know. I don't know what it is. Everyone I talk to is an enthusiastic snow sports slider. So maybe I'm biased.
As you get ready to walk out the door, Tom, there's a lot of long-term challenges facing skiing. There's climate change. There's this evolution and consolidation of the industry. How are you feeling about this industry that you've really dedicated your life to? Are you optimistic about skiing's future?
Oh yeah, I am. I mean, this climate change, everybody has to kind of figure out how we're going to deal with that. I'm optimistic about it. We've got big snowmaking systems and we just got to make sure we run them efficiently and make snow when you can. And if there's temperature swings, you got to be able to figure out what to do with it. And it's a lot easier to run a place now than it was 20 years ago. And I'm very optimistic about it. I will miss it. Who knows what I'll do. I do have a place in Park City, so I'll be out there next winter. But, I'm optimistic about it because I think it's run by a bunch of people that get it and know what to do and how to react to the weather and climate changes. And I just think that everyone knows what they're doing in this business. And there's a lot of people that are trying to make sure it keeps rolling the right way. So I'm very optimistic. I think there's a bunch of smart people that run these places, the big guys, the small guys, everybody that does it because they love it and they want to make sure that they can make it successful.
So much has changed. I think if I would have said to you in 1978, hey, Tom, when you finish up your ski career, you're going to be charging $104 peak day for a lift ticket at the last ski area you're on, and that's going to be considered a bargain. I mean, it's funny. How hard was it psychologically for you to actually crack the $100 mark at Gunstock? Because this is the first season where a peak day lift ticket, and I realize you have much cheaper tickets for night and all these other things, but that's your peak ticket. Was that difficult for you psychologically, or was it just, expenses go up this percent and the ticket has to go up this percent?
Expenses go up this percent. You look at what everybody else is charging and you just charge a little bit more. It's based on the expenses. You don't see anybody really complaining about it. This is the 10% to complain about everything. But other than that, it's what it is. And that never bothered me because I always felt that whatever we charged, the product that we're putting out there is worth it.
And the main product seems to be season pass sales. And you have actually limited these every year since COVID. What can you tell us about the number of season passes that you sell? If you increase that number of year, what your target is for 24, 25?
Well, that's one of the numbers I probably don't want to spew out, but we sell a ton of them and we always end up having to shut them off because we sell more every year. And we see, this is the weirdest number to me, is we see 20 to 30% new pass holders every year. Now,
really?
Maybe some of them didn't have a pass the year before, but they did the year before that. But we kind of look at that. So that kind of means that 20% are dropping out and we're filling in the leaky bucket with 20% more. But we do see a lot of new skier visits. And I think that has to do with they maybe came here two or three times and realized that it's not crowded. It's a nice experience. It's a nice little mountain. It's got some good skiing. The conditions are good. Got a great snow sports school. And they go and buy a pass because they said, you know, this is, you know, I'm going to come here enough that it's going to be worth it. So I think that's what it is. And we do sell a ton of them. We sell right out of the gate, you know, it always amazes me too, because, you know, they go up exponentially for the two, three tiers. It always amazes me how many people wait till the end. And the pass costs $200 or $300 more, and they wait till the end to buy it. And there's a lot of them. And I can never figure it out what the, you know, I don't, that is always surprising to me. But yeah, we see a lot of new pass holders every year, and which is encouraging.
So you got to start thinking about your own passes now, Tom. Did you get your Epic Pass for next year yet, or your Deer Valley Pass?
I have not, but you know, at my age, things get cheaper. In fact, they joked with me here is that at 70 years old, you can ski for free here. So they said, you just waited till you could get a free ticket here before you retired. I haven't got my Epic Pass yet, but I will. I worked at Park City when I was out there before, a couple mornings a week doing greeting outside the ticket office. I'll probably go back and do that again because it's fun to meet young people and be around stuff like that. In fact, you know, talking about the old things, I had some young kids working with me and someone came up and asked if there was a payphone and they didn't know what it was. And so they came over to me and they said, hey, Tom, this guy wants a payphone. Do you know what a payphone is? I said, yes. And so there was one left. It was down by the shop. So at the end of the day, they're like, hey, will you take us down to look at a payphone?
That's amazing.
And I said, sure. So we went down. And of course, now they use credit cards. But it used to be, you guys, that we didn't have cell phones, which just stunned them. That you didn't have a cell phone. And I said, yeah, no, we didn't have cell phones. So you'd be driving along and you need to make a phone call. And there was a phone booth on the side of the road. And you'd go to the phone booth and you'd have coins in your car or your pocket. And you'd have to put in like, you know, 5 dimes or 2 quarters. And they'd call you and say, you must deposit 10 cents more. And trucks would be driving by and the phone booth would be swaying in the breeze. And they're like, really? Really? You didn't have cell phones then? I go, no, we didn't have cell phones. This is a payphone. They were shocked over that. So that's when I knew I'm really old.
That's unbelievable. But that kind of stuff, I think, keeps you young when you're out and active. And you seem like a person who lives a really big life. You also had done a little side work for Mountain Guard, you told me last time you were on the podcast. Is that something you could see yourself doing again, some mountain inspections just for a little adventure, get out there a little?
Yeah, it was a great way to see ski areas all over the planet. We did everything west of Park City. If they'd have me back, you know, I would probably go back and do it again. It's a nice way to meet other ski area operators and people that work at different ski areas. And I ended up doing a lot of smaller areas too, which was fun because they still exist out west. And it was neat to see families run businesses and what they did and kids skiing, people skiing in Carhartts and, you know, that type of stuff. So yeah, I would do something like that just to, I'm not a good, that's why we've retired 3 times. I'm really bad at like sitting still for a while. And my wife has lectured me about that quite a bit. So she's told me I'm not allowed to answer the phone anymore.
Well, Tom, I appreciate you sitting still for 80 or 90 minutes or whatever we've been on the phone today. So thank you so much for the insight. I really appreciate it. And sincerely, a big congratulations on a great career. And it sounds like you're going to have a great life afterwards because you know how to live and that's a pretty rare skill. So thanks for your time, Tom. I really appreciate it and congratulations on a great career.
Thanks, Stuart. Always great talking to you.
That's Tom Day, outgoing president and general manager of Gunstock, New Hampshire. Tom, you are walking off a legend. Bravo on an all-time performance to finish off a remarkable career. Take a bow, my man. You have earned it. Thank you all very much for listening. New Hampshire, I am set to blow up your inbox with more leaders from your excellent and amazing ski state, as the general managers of Wildcat and Mount Sunapee are set to join me in the coming months. Next up, I already have episodes recorded with the leaders of Panorama, BC and Bluewood, Washington. Looking ahead, I have conversations booked with the leaders of Mission Ridge, Washington, Whitegrass, West Virginia, Tyrol Basin, Wisconsin, Blue Knob, Pennsylvania, Kirkwood, California, Whistler and Cypress, BC, Fernie, BC, A-Basin, Colorado, and Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and I am booking more all the time. To get those episodes the moment they're live, please visit stormskiing.com and subscribe to the Storm Skiing newsletter. New pods will appear in your email box several hours before syncing with the podcast services, including Apple and Spotify. There are free and paid tiers of the newsletter, and paid subscribers always receive podcasts 7 days before everyone else. You can also follow The Storm on Twitter and Instagram at Storm Ski Journal. Until next time, stay well, stay safe. I'm Stuart Winchester, and I'll talk to you again very soon.
The Storm Skiing Podcast is a Quicksilver Films production.